So Tali.
Yes.
Finally. We've been trying to get this together for a while. But I knew we'd get it. This is just the beginning. So I'm doing this documentary on observing the observant.
Right.
I grew up in a kind of conservative neighborhood in Borough Park. It's okay. I don't mind. I like actually background.
Okay, good.
So I grew up in Borough Park as a kid. I went to the synagogue that we were at, my grandfather, first time. And it was interesting because my grandfather was conservative. And that OPJC, which is the Ocean Parkway Jewish Center, I probably was in there in my mother's womb. Walking around the other day, I saw a plaque with my grandfather's name on it.
That's very nice.
Avraham Varikas, and he died in 1952. But it's interesting because I remember my mother always looking at the Orthodox observant Jews as if they were from some other strange century brought out of time, in a time that's out of time. And so I was brought up with these guys make us look bad because they're
dressed.
They come out of some other space and time.
Right. And there's a stubbornness to them.
Yeah. Now I meet you, who's kind of floating energy, this kind of this Wonder Woman who finds herself somewhere. Where is that somewhere?
You know, it's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking about how I think I've never felt that I had to choose or that I had to leave something to get something else. I grew up very typically modern Orthodox and Flatbush, which meant we went to a Jewish day school. We wore pants on the weekends. My mom and other women only covered their hair in shul. And for me, that was just very much a very natural beginning of Judaism, where you're very frim and you live in a Jewish neighborhood and send your kids to a Jewish day school, but you're also working in the world and somehow making it work. That said, I probably didn't have non-Jewish friends until I got to college. But I think for me, I can't pinpoint it exactly, but I think I always believed, and I think I always felt that I like this Judaism. And it was never like, oh, I want to rebel against my parents by throwing off the yoke of religion. So I've always been Shomer Shabbos, even in college. I remember in college I had friends who became not observant for certain periods because it was too stressful to sometimes study for term papers or write theses or other things when you have Shabbos and the Chagim in the way. And I think for me it was always, I really felt this sense of more than we keep Shabbos, Shabbos keeps us. So I think for me, if anything, the changes that came on the surface probably came more through feminism. And for me, on the one hand, knowing a lot and being very educated and studying Gemara from sixth grade all throughout school. After graduating college, I lived in Israel for 2 years, and that's when I had a Gemara Chavrusa at the conservative yeshiva. And that's when I started davening Igel. And the beginning, it was very strange being there with men and thinking, oh, this is such strangeness. And then really feeling like I counted. And not in this, like, I'm going to go back to the shul that I grew up in with some kind of banner and try to change things, but somehow it just felt very natural. So, but I guess the space that you were saying I float in between is like my main shul is Karlebach. My main shul isn't an egalitarian shul. I love the Karlebach Shul. It's a bit like Chilent. It's very welcoming. And I always say it's the most welcoming shul. You don't have ushers. You don't have people who are appointed to stand by the door and welcome you. But somehow it's more welcoming than any shul that has that. And I also like the broken vessels. I think that not everyone has to be perfect Upper West Side, career, made it, to be welcome in a community on the Upper West Side. So I think for me, I always just felt very, my evolution, I've always been able to do it within Judaism, and Judaism gives me so much. And then later on when I thought about it, we don't have any Litvaks in my family. We're either Hasidim or modern Orthodox or people who moved to conservative, my aunt and uncle, America, that type of stuff. But the stock is Hasidish, so I think that kind of passion and Dveikus, and I think it comes from there.
And how do you see being observant in your own mind? I mean, how does that translate in your imagination?
What do you mean, how do I see it?
I mean, how do you see yourself? You're a young woman who's not married, but marriage is an important thing in your life.
Yes, it is.
At this point in your life.
Yes, it is. How do I see being observant?
And being a woman who is observant as well.
Yeah, I think the women who are observant have the challenge. I think the men might feel the pressure more to daven 3 times a day or do the more outward things. And I think it's the women, particularly in my community, Orthodox, because we're the most educated women. We have more years under our belts than women who grew up in the conservative movement or reform, even though they get to do more in the synagogue. They get to do more at the pulpit. They get to be rabbis. But somehow we are the ones that will know more Mishnah, Talmud, Chumash, better Jewish and better Hebrew skills. I think for me, being observant, for me, I would say 2 things. First, being observant for me means that I'm not fully free, that I have a master, and that master is Hashem. And Hashem took us out of Egypt to serve him. So I'm not just here to do whatever I want, to be a journalist at CBS or work for Bloomberg or do a bunch of stuff. It's also, there's a mission, and I'm part of this mission, and I have work to do. And I have a commitment to the Jewish community. So that's one thing just for me, what it means to be observant. And I think what it means to be a woman, I think it's to bump up against a lot of ceilings. And instead of just saying that the ceilings are, society hasn't changed yet, and little by little women get the corner office, they become CEO, they become Secretary of State, they run for the presidency, Hillary Clinton. I think that what's hard about it in Judaism is that it's not so simple. It's not just an idea that hasn't happened yet, but there's a lot of tradition that ossifies over halacha till that becomes halacha. And part of, I think, what the Jewish women's project is to peel off the barnacles with our nails, literally, of like what is custom and what is halacha, and how can we get back to women doing more things that won't be seeming as threatening to the Jewish stronghold and the ways of doing things.
What is the most challenging part about being a woman in this Hasidic Orthodox world for you?
What's the most challenging? I think part of it is that not being able to fully express yourself. You know, I love davening. I'd be happy to be a Shliach Tzibur. Maybe not always, that wouldn't be my job. But, you know, I love nigunim. I like to pick my own tunes for Kedusha or davening on Shabbos. And I think sometimes people question your motives. Is that you really want to do it? Or is it some dafka thing that you're trying to prove or you're trying to encroach on the man's space? And I think another challenge in being a Jewish woman is that we grow up with a lot of, you know, what does it mean to be a Jewish wife and what does it mean to be a Jewish mother? And I think for me, sometimes it's tricky. I have friends who are not religious. So whenever like I'm whining about, I'm looking for someone, I haven't found someone yet, husband-wise, they always say that's your problem, that you're looking in the Jewish world and that they're not going to want someone like you. Because people who are really firm are not going to want someone who's as educated or outspoken as you are. And the people who would want that are not people who are going to be Shomer Shabbos and not going to be observant. And I think that's what's tricky. That's what's hard for me, to be in that space of religious and traditional, but also a feminist and an individual. And I think it's hard to find men in the Jewish world who can do both or have to do both, or a lot of them don't have to choose, so they just want the traditional wife. Or they leave the fold and then they just look for someone outside the fold also.
It's interesting. I've been trying to get a conversation between Mimi and her
Mimi Klein.
Her father. Mm-hmm. Now, Mimi, her father taught Mimi how to think.
Yeah.
And in thinking, she thought outside the box, which to me means that she learned how to think and then she questioned.
Right.
But that's part of the Jewish culture, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the box has never been 2 inches by 2 inches. So for me, thinking outside the box, for me, I've always been able to do that within being observant. And not because I wasn't fully questioning and fully thinking, so that was some kind of taboo. It was always just, Shabbos is so powerful. What am I going to change that so that my Saturday is when I hand in my dry cleaning? What am I gaining when I'm giving certain things up? I have another Wednesday, but now I'm just calling it Saturday, another day that I'm doing work or on my BlackBerry. Like, it's so not attractive to me. What can I not do? What do I have to do on Saturday that I can't do any other day? And I think, I don't know, look, you know, I grew up in a modern Orthodox family and both my siblings are not religious anymore. My brother became not religious shortly after he moved to Israel because for him, he's more of a lone wolf character and the communal aspect of Judaism was too much for him. Shabbos meals and everyone's always together. I think he always felt excluded and eventually left the fold, I think, because of that. And then my sister married someone who is not religious, so they became not religious. And it's very weird for me to think that I'm the only one of three children that all had the same exact education, the same number of years in Jewish camp, that isn't anymore. And I see my nephews with their Saturday Little League baseball, and I think it's a shame. I think it's a shame to not grow up with, you know, also being observant gives you access to, if you know Hebrew or just being in that train of things, Midrash and stories, amazing stories of Mashiach and Eliyahu HaNavi coming, and it's so fantastic. Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking with Rabbi Akiva, and even though these people lived 2,000 years apart, they're having a conversation. And I think now, especially we live in a world that you can look up everything and Wikipedia and what's true and what's not true. I think there's something very amazing for young minds to grow up with parables. You know, so many parables are like, the king had a son and he told his son, you know, and all these stories are amazing and you're not going to get them at PS 124. It's not geology and it's not science and it's not history and it's not civics. It's amazing stories of the poor couple and someone knocked on the door and said, can I join you for Shabbos? And they thought, we don't have any more food. And it turns out to be Eliyahu HaNavi and he gives them wealth and he gives them a bunch of children. But these are stories of hope and they're stories that are deep. And I think there's, you get the ocean and you start learning how to swim in it. And sometimes you feel like the ocean is too big, but they teach you how to swim and then you get an ocean, not a pool.
What is it about the community, the culture, the life, what is it that attracts you?
By the community, you mean of the observant or
of the
Jews
observer.
Or?
Well, you're Shomer Shabbos.
Yeah.
You honor. What does Shomer Shabbos mean to you?
What does it mean to me? That the second I light candles, I'm in another space. No matter what happened during the week or in the minutes leading up to Shabbos, the harriedness, the craziness, the work, whatever's going on, it all stops, and this new energy of Shabbos comes in, and it's a different light, and it's a different dimension. It's spending time with friends, and it's spending time with family, and it's spending time with Hashem, and it's spending time with the world, not touching it and not changing it and not creating something new, but just being with things as they are. And also, it's a day that people say, whatever you want for on Shabbos, everything is perfect. Everything works out. And even if that ends on Saturday night, it's still a day of everything is the way it's supposed to be. And I think in our modern world where so much isn't the way it's supposed to be, or we see all the cracks, there's something to being in a day of wholeness. What does it mean to me to be in this kind of community? I think it means to be in a community of people that are on a spiritual path. And people who believe, and people who have higher forces in their world. It's not just the right job, or the right community, or the right clothing, or the right house, or the right career, but it's something else going on. There's another dimension. It's religious. It's spiritual. I also love that under this umbrella of the observant, there's many, many different ways of doing it. You know, some people are observant, and they don't really have a relationship with Hashem. It's much more rote. This is what they do, and they do it three times a day, and that's okay. It's a different kind of orthodoxy, but it's orthodoxy. And then other people who are infusing everything, and then people who are someplace in between those two, doing things because you're supposed to, even if you're not so into it, and other things that give great value and meaning to your life.
Where do you see yourself in that kind of plethora, that rainbow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've always said I feel like I'm in the both. On the one hand, I'm like, I feel comfortable in the intellectual PhD niche, and I've been to Shabbos tables or hosted Shabbos meals where it's very, we're talking about politics and the world and big issues. And then other Shabbos meals that I love where we're just singing, and it's all nigunim, and anything goes. And it doesn't have to be people who know so much, but it's just more of coming from the heart. And I think for me, I have a balance of both. Of I love having textual skills and knowing stuff. I usually study Gemara in the summers, and that's important to me. And then other things that are very important to me is having people feel welcome in a space that I'm in, and creating something very special through music, through song, through being open to bending things and to looking at things in different ways.
What would you tell your children? What would you tell your daughter?
About what?
Just who you are, what your experience, what would you want your daughter to know?
You know, I think about that sometimes, and I think, but I want them to grow up the way I grew up, and then to expand their capabilities on their own. Do I think that it'd be more fair to send them to a school or a synagogue that was egalitarian to begin with, so they didn't have to feel included when they were very young, then excluded for a long time, and then have to create new spaces to find a way back in? Sometimes I really actually do think about that, you know? Would they have the koach? Would they have the power to find their own way, you know, or should I give them a better world to begin with and not have them go through the hard stuff to get to where they are? And other times I get worried, like, what if they were to become totally observant and not be feminists? Would I be able to recognize them as my children, you know, if I had a daughter who was getting married at 19 and covering her hair and totally subjugating herself to her husband's will? Or to rabbi's will, I sometimes think that that would be hard for me, you know?
Yeah, that I can see as being challenging, to see the path that you could have taken as your daughter.
Yeah, but also a path that I wouldn't want them to take. You know, I'd want them to go to college, I would want them to travel, I would want them to, I guess, do things that I've done and to be able to fully explore who they are and fully breathe into who they are and not have a very thin version that someone else wants of them. What would I tell my daughters? I think I'd want them to be happy with who they are, and I'd want to be there for them without hovering, for them to really have their own authentic relationship with Hashem and within Judaism. And if they didn't want to be religious, I feel like I would want to give them the skills and the toolkit. And what they do when they become young adults is their decision.
You're a single woman. What is that like in this observant world?
Oh my gosh. It's very hard and it's very stressful. What is that like? I mean, it's hard. You know, I think a lot of guys who, I think for me, I don't have a choice but to be a feminist. And I think for a lot of guys, maybe you don't want to come home and your wife is still at work. Maybe you want her to be home with the kids and to be really happy in that space. Sometimes I wonder, if I was an Orthodox guy, if I were observant, would I want to marry a woman who has had her own life and did her own thing? But I think, again, I would want a true partner, someone who is a thinker and interesting and brought a lot to my life. So I guess I would date me.
Would you date you?
I would. I would date me. I think that it would be an adventure.
You?
I would. I would marry me. I would marry me.
Challenging, huh?
It is challenging.
How would you describe the Orthodox men that you out there?
I mean, the ones that I date or just at large?
At large.
I think a lot of them do religion by rote. It's more just, this is what they learned and this is what they do. I think a lot of them also are very comfortable within tradition and don't want women knocking on the doors and changing things. I think, what else do I think about the Jewish men? I think sometimes I think they have a little bit hard. I think there's so much of a pressure on observant men to be providers and to bear the cost of living in an observant neighborhood and sending your kids to an observant school, which usually means these things come at a very high price tag. And I think a lot of times observant guys don't get to fully explore their own selves. I think a lot of them are probably more into the social sciences and literature and other kinds of fields. I don't think that all Orthodox men really want to be doctors, lawyers, engineers, computer developers, finance guys. I think they go into it because of the price tag of being observant. When really left to their own devices, they would probably be going into the humanities. So I think sometimes they have it tough also, and there's a lot of pressure there.
And what is it to be from, for people who don't know what it's to be from, who may listen to this?
What does it mean to be from? I think it's to, like, live in the year 2012 and to live in the year 12. You know, I think it's on the one hand to be very much of this world, and I think if you saw us on the outside, we would look like anybody else, unless you really had different clothing. But if not, it would be you're very much in the year 2012, and you have iPhones, and you have hot water, and you have gizmos and gadgets. And then there's also part of my lifestyle that's very, I wouldn't say the dark ages, because it's not dark in that kind of ignorant way. But on Shabbos, you know, I'm not using electricity, and I'm not using my computer, and I'm not using my phone. And I think, in a way, there's something almost Amish about it, that you're at one. And I think what you learn about that is, as much as I'm very thankful for technology, especially in the medical field, I also know that we tamper and we tinker a lot, and that sometimes the world is just fine as it is. I think I would also tell people that weren't observant, looking at the observant, that there's also, I think, a lot of struggle when you do have a sense that there's a higher power out there that expects things from you, that demands things of you, that you have the sense that there's something I should be doing, and am I doing it? Am I living up to what I'm supposed to be? I think a lot of people who are not observant, you're just living your life and you're evolving as you evolve. And I think when you're observant, you almost have like a superimposed image of yourself that's near you or above you or somehow on you, but it's not a perfect fit. And you're always trying to grow and move in that direction.
Is that comfortable?
No, but there's growth. And here's another thing that I was thinking while speaking. I think also being observant, there's a huge love story. You have a huge love story going on between you and God. And it's a love story within your life, within everything else that's going on. It's a huge love story, I think, for the Jewish people, but especially for relationship with God. And I think it's a full relationship. Sometimes you're disappointed, and sometimes you're angry, and sometimes you're upset. And sometimes you feel at one and together and elated and so grateful. But it's a huge love story.
And yet, women who are from are... What are the responsibilities of being from?
You mean everything from, like, dietary and dress and Sabbath, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, just what to fit into that.
It's a whole lifestyle. It's like from the time that I wake up in the morning literally till I go at night. There's certain things that without even me just being me, I know are going to happen. You know, when I wake up in the morning, I open up my eyes and I say a blessing. You know?
Which is what? Walk me through your day.
Yeah, I hear my alarm, and then I open up my eyes and I say the blessing, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Pokeach Ivrim, which means blessed art thou, God, who opens up the eyes of the blind. And that's kind of the first thing I say in the morning, because I'm opening up my eyes, and it kind of starts with that. And then I go to the bathroom, and then I say a blessing that all my bowel movements are functioning properly. And it might sound funny, but it's also just being an awareness of there but for the grace of God go I. And in very minute things and in very grand things. I, in the past, like, few months have started again praying every day, but I haven't for a bit. Usually I just pray on the Sabbath, but I'll be praying in the morning. And then I'll go about my day, work or yoga or whatever.
What's your prayers like and how long do they take?
I usually pray twice a day. You know, I'm usually able to catch like the morning prayer in the afternoon or the afternoon and the evening.
At home, or you go to
at home?
At home. Any special time?
I mean, the morning prayer is in the morning when I wake up, and the afternoon is any time from midday until it gets dark outside. And then the night prayer is when three stars have come out and it's nighttime. So from the morning when I open up my eyes and I'm saying a blessing, there's already awareness. When I go to the bathroom, there's an awareness. If I'm eating food, there's an awareness. And then it's also how I end the day. It's almost like I'm checking my soul back into the locker up in the heavens and also saying a blessing. And I think it's almost like that kind of cycle. I think being observant, it's a daily cycle, but it's also a weekly cycle with the Sabbath. And then with all the holidays, it's a certain energy. Like my life, for me, the new year will always start in the fall with Rosh Hashanah, with the Jewish New Year and Yom Kippur. And it's its own psychic cycle of introspection, atonement, then joy in the Sukkah with the Feast of Tabernacles. It's like a whole, it's guideposts on a daily basis, an hourly basis, a monthly basis, a weekly basis, a yearly basis of what's going to, and I move through these posts, but the posts aren't mine. And there are many of the, that's what the community is. We're all moving through these posts in our own way, but they're there. The markers are there. How we go through them, what we do with them is our own question, but they're there. That's the rhythm. That's the rhythm. That's like the big, that's the rhythm of my life. And then I get to live my own life, but it's going to be through this and with this.
Now, from what I understand from some of the from women here, there are certain you're not supposed to touch. Can you explain a little bit of what that's like?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also different levels of observance. So I didn't grow up being Shomer Negiah. Shomer Negiah is awareness of the touch. So men and women who are not married will not be touching. I think I do exhibit that in that I'm not a casual toucher. I don't usually hug people that I don't know well or just give them a casual. Like, I don't casually touch people. I mean, shaking someone's hand is fine. But it's like an awareness of this kind of contact that it's most intimate is meant for a husband and a wife. And it's not something to be cheapened or diluted by any male-female exchange is going to have this dynamic to it.
What I'm trying to understand is the male-female relationship in the observant from community.
Yeah.
Because I think that would be interesting for somebody who might listen to this about what it's like. I mean,
right.
Even though do you consider yourself modern Orthodox now?
Yes.
Or Hasidic?
No, I mean, I didn't grow up Hasidish. I mean, many of my, you know, my first cousins are, many people in my family are. So I grew up going to their weddings and their being part of their simchas and being in their houses. But my family grew up, my parents are modern Orthodox. The great parents, you know, my grandparents are Hasidish, but they grew up Hasidish when they were younger. But when they were living in Israel, they were already modern Orthodox when they came together. But my grandmother, my safta, were a shaitel. She wore a wig and she only wore skirts. And I think with men and women in the observant world, it's very delineated. There's male and there's female. It's not androgynous. It's not unisex. I think that's the big difference between the modern Orthodox world and just the modern world. Being observant, there's male and there's female. And they're different and they're distinct. And I think the interactions between male and female, there is also usually a kind of sense, if you're in a certain age and you're single, of tachlis, of translation for tachlis, if there has to be some kind of consequence to it. Not consequence, purpose. It's not just like frilly and flirting and we'll see what happens, but like this could go somewhere and therefore there's usually an underpinning, I think, of seriousness. Of, oh, can this be my future husband and can this be my future wife? And I think also because the synagogue, you're separated from men, that becomes almost like a more normal way of interacting, that men and women aren't fully mixed like oil and water. There's always a degree of other and separate to it.
You know, we're all kind of caught in this emotional, biological beings that we are. How does that play out in the from... both on both sides.
What do you mean, the oneness of us?
No, I'm thinking, you know, people have hormones.
Yeah. How does that play out? I mean, in the Hasidic world, it plays out by a lot of exhortations against masturbation on the part of men, boys. and also a lot of withholding of information. Most people in the Hasidic world will not know about the birds and the bees until, you know, 2 weeks before they get married.
Oh, 2 weeks.
You know, and some the day of, they'll get like a little primer. Women usually get it a little bit before because they're also learning about family purity laws and menstruation. You know, it's very interesting to me. I remember speaking about this with a friend of mine when I got older, that I really think in high school, you know, we were separated for Hebrew Judaic subjects and we were together with boys for English subjects. And I really remember thinking that I was like pre-sexual, that I would somehow watch TV, Degrassi High or other shows where they weren't even high school, they were still in elementary school. And they always seemed so much more advanced and sexual and mature than people were in my high school, because we weren't hooking up and we weren't having sex and we weren't really drinking alcohol, most of us, and we weren't using drugs. And it was so different than friends of mine who went to public school, who at 15 were already raiding the parents' liquor cabinet. And not that people who went to public school didn't have morals, but just somehow there was more testing and pushing the boundaries and experimenting. And I think when you grow up observant, there's a lot of fences, there's a lot of boundaries, and a lot of things that's not just you're not allowed to do because I said so as your parent, or you're not supposed to do it because you're too young. I think when you grow up observant, this would be a sin, or this would be against the way that we're supposed to be doing things. I think that holds more weight than just, do you listen to your parents? It's, do you listen to God? Do you listen to the Bible? Do you listen to halacha, to the codes of law of what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do? So I think that always adds an element. I think it's like what I said before, you grow up with fences, many more fences.
How do you deal with that?
So I think in high school I wasn't even aware of them. When I say pre-sexual, I think it's because I wasn't even, like, we didn't have sex ed, but it was also like, it didn't even dawn on me like that I would be having sex when I was in high school. It's like, yeah, when you get married, that's when that is going
to
happen. Not that
went,
I didn't know what
college.
It was.
Sure, what?
But I went to college, but still.
What kind of college did you go to?
Penn,
right.
Yeah. Ivy League, co-ed dorms. But still, it was just, I felt fortified. I mean, it wasn't that I was some zealot. It was just, I can be in this world, in this larger, modernisha, modern world, and yet still have my own set of values and guiding principles that navigate me through things.
I just think it's kind of an interesting dynamic that I'm trying to understand for myself as a passionate being, which you are too.
Yes.
How do you wrap your mind around that mindset of being from as you get older as well?
Right. I mean, I think it's different for different people. You know, I think some people are shomer negia, so then they're not going to have any contact. And some people will have some contact, but not intercourse. I think different people fall along the spectrum of what allows them to be human and to not go crazy because they're living in a way that feels very repressed, and to still have holiness and meaning in your life. And I think it's a balance.
I read somewhere that it's okay for, and correct me if I'm wrong,
for women to masturbate and not for men.
No, that for men to go to prostitutes.
No, that's like malarkey. Dangerous and diseases. I think, I don't know. You know, I think also the whole concept of, oh, men have urges and men, I think
women
also
same,
do.
Women,
I think women also have libido. Some men have low libido, some women have really high libidos. Yeah, I think
same.
That's Bubba myself. Yeah, I think it's the same. I think the problem with the current observant world is that we're not all getting married at the age of 19 or 21. I think it works for people not to touch as long as they're getting married shortly after high school. But once you have people who are 43, 35, 42, 28, it's already a bit of a different story.
50, yeah.
I think that's why they call it now a shidduch crisis. And that's why you have a crisis now, people who are observant and cannot meet their partner, and then so much of Judaism, so much of the restrictions become permissible during marriage, and so much of the micro unit of Judaism is the family, that when you're single, you just feel like, A, you're missing out, B, you're denying yourself, and see you're not fully living a Jewish life because you're not building a Jewish home with the Jewish husband, with the Jewish partner, with the Jewish children. So you feel like, well, then what am I doing? I'm not having a full expression of what I'm supposed to be having.
I wonder about those people who are caught in between. There are a lot of people who drop out because of too much mental stress.
Right.
What's going on in there?
You know, it's very interesting. When I was walking here, I had gone on a date this evening. And it wasn't such a great date. And when he was walking, and he was like, oh, I've heard of that Shulin thing, and I went there once. And all these people that have left or off the derech, off the path, observant Judaism. And I remember saying, they're not off the path. You know, just the fact that you're coming to Shulin and coming to this type of gathering means that you're still connected and wanting something from it. But wait, what was your original question to this? Oh, what happens to people that can't deal?
Yeah,
I mean, but that to me, dropouts and the stress of it, I think that's true of any system. I think you're always going to have dropouts. I think you can have the best system, the most airtight, and there's always going to be people that don't jive with it or come with problems from the get-go or have certain kinds of really difficult childhoods or difficult experiences that make it. Like for me, I'm sad that my sister is not religious anymore and that by extension my nephews aren't religious, but I'm actually happy for my brother that he left the Jewish community. I think Judaism might be for him, but Jewish community is not for him. It was very stifling and very confining for him. So I don't regret that he's not religious. It doesn't make me sad. I feel like I'm very happy that he feels he can live more of an authentic life.
I wonder if maybe sometimes being observant can also be the obstacle.
Yes, I agree. Someone was talking to me about this group called Footsteps that works with Hasidic people, very observant people who have left the community, and it gives them some job training and other things. But I think majority of people that work in that organization, people that used to be very observant and now aren't observant at all. I remember emailing them and offering myself as a volunteer, and my selling point was that I'm like a halfway house. You know, I'm not Hasidic, where they're growing up with so many strictures that it really is, one can go crazy, and it's just too much. And I think there you have a greater dropout rate. It's not because of people's inabilities. It's because the system has been taken to a point that's unnatural. But I think to go and to lose everything is very drastic. And I felt that what I would be able, or the modern orthodoxy flag was able to show, is that you can be Sabbath observant, and you can be observant and have God in your life without only wearing two colors, and without having 9 children, and without not going to college. That there's a way to have a meaningful religious life without everything else that came with it in the way that they grew up.
And what is your relationship to God?
What is my relationship with God? I think it's a few things. I think sometimes it feels like what I was saying before, that God took us out of Egypt, not to be free men, but to be slaves to God. But not slaves in the way that we think about it with pre-Civil War America, African Americans. But that there's a contract, there's a relationship, there's a covenant. There's a covenant. You know, we have ancestors that had a very one-to-one relationship with God, and then it got diluted because there have been so many of us. And I think sometimes it feels like that, like there are certain things that are expected of me that I need to do because this is part of the covenant. And then other times where I feel like God is looking out for me and it's more personal. You know how I really think about relationship with God? Before, when you pray alone, not in a minyan, not in a quorum, you say, before you say the Shema, like one of the central prayers, you say El Melech Ne'eman. You say God, King, Confidant. And I think that's what I feel. Sometimes I feel that God is a God, a kind of all-powerful, running the show. I don't understand how it all connects and why certain things happen, but I believe that God, there's a larger plan, even though I don't see it. And sometimes I feel like God's the king. God is powerful, and if I just pray enough, he can pull some strings, and he can grant some favors, and he can move things around. And then other times I feel Ne'eman. I feel that God is a confidant, and that we are very one-on-one. And he's not far away. He's not up in the heavens. He's not out there. or so above and beyond, but something that's a lot more close to me.
And what's it like benching lach for you?
Benching licht before Shabbos? I love it. I mean, look, I didn't grow up Chabad, you know, so I didn't grow up with the only thing that women have is to, like, set the Shabbos table, clean the house for Pesach, Passover, and light Shabbos candles. I think for me what I love about it is two things. Like, I love that in a way God gave us the Sabbath, but that we create it. If I don't light candles and if I'm not Sabbath observant, then who cares what God did on the seventh day of creation? I don't have Sabbath in my life. And I love that when I light the candles, it's like an active participation in the Sabbath. Maybe on the Sabbath we let go and let God, but that process can only take place once I do something. And I think when I bench licht, it's like great power to say, it's always like a very harried day on Friday. And then when I light candles, it's like, oh, you know? The room takes on a different glow because it's candlelight. You know what made me laugh? I remember when we had a blackout in New York. All my Jewish friends, it wasn't a big deal. We all have candles. We all have candles in our cupboards. And I think there's something very elemental about it, to candles and the glow and the light. And once I light the candles, that's it. Shabbos has started. And even if I'm not going to synagogue, even if I'm just going to read a book, lie down, take it easy, doing things that to the naked eye, it's not really Shabbistic. It's not really of the Sabbath. It looks like any other day that I'm just reading a book and doing nothing. But for me, because I've lit the candles, it's within the Sabbath. And it's special. It takes on a different cast.
Yeah, I remember my mother lighting the candles, and she always kissed me on the forehead.
Yeah. My mom also, if I'm ever home, she would always, like, Shabbos, and then we would each get, like, a kiss. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure.
Why is it that men don't?
They have an obligation to do. I think people don't because they grew up and their mom did it, and the men went to synagogue. But it's halacha, it's the law that every household has to have lit candles. So men who live by themselves are obligated to light candles. It's not a woman's thing. Any home has to light candles for Sabbath. You know, and if there's no women or the woman passed away or you're not married, you have to light candles.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And what about inbreeding?
I think I don't feel it as much. I think I see it more with my very religious cousins who are within certain Hasidic sects, and they only marry one another. And then within certain sects, there are even more limitations based on certain rabbis. So it's really even a smaller, really is like just 10,000 of them marrying within one another. I mean, I don't really think about it so much. I think that, especially living in New York, you have, maybe it's a false sense, but you definitely have a sense that there are so many observant Jews, so it doesn't feel like it's a small pool. But, you know, people that I know, just last week, they had a 2-year-old who died. She had a genetic disease. And, right, sometimes I wonder if we're just a smaller gene pool. I mean, I feel like Orthodox Jews have been around for a long time. I think because of now, we've been spread to two main diasporas, America and Israel, and Jews from all over have gone there, Argentina and Vienna and Morocco and Russia, because we're getting pushed to two centers. I think that there's more influx of new genes in the pool. I mean, it's still within Jews, but it's not like, I think it really used to be worse. You were in your shtetl and there were 10 Jewish families and you got to pick one of them to be your intended. And I think now that we're getting pushed to two poles, I think there's more recombinations.
And what about the volume of children that are born? I mean, what is that about?
You mean in the more observant families that have nine children, 13? I have cousins that have 13 children.
You have cousins who have 13 children?
Yeah, and that house is run like a tight ship. You've never seen anything like it. It is they are poor, and it is a very small home. Their dining room is like folding tables and plastic lawn chairs, but it is the most spick and span well-run. The older kids take care of the younger kids. Look, part of it is not using birth control. I think part of it is post-Holocaust making up for the 6 million. People really have a sense of our numbers as Jews have been depleted. And it's our responsibility to replenish the pool. And I think part of it is the core belief that your greatest treasure and your greatest work is going to be your children. It's not going to be wealth, and it's not going to be the cars in your garage. It's going to be the children. And that if you create more Jewish babies, then you're sending out more Jewish lights into the world. And what could be more important than that?
It's interesting because my mother always sensed that her children were her most precious.
Right.
And she taught that to me as well. That sense of, it's not about what you have, it's what you do in some ways.
Right. I sometimes think of like Jewish children as almost a Jewish army. You know, it's like you're sending them out in the world to do good or to kind of... I think about it sometimes. I think it's also an expression of faith that God will provide, that even if you have a family that has humble means and humble resources, and they have another child, I think the sense is that God will somehow make this work. And you don't have to worry that not everyone will have a laptop, not everyone will be able to pay for yeshiva day school, religious tuition, but that somehow God will provide. I think it's also an expression of faith.
And observing the observant, what have you observed?
What have I observed? I mean, I worked as a journalist and a producer for many years, so I think I've always been very observant. Like, I literally stare at people on the train. So can I say that I've only been observing the observant, or that I... Can I think of things that I only... I think I'm not thinking of it. I mean, look, I'm definitely very invested in this movement and in observancy continuing. So I am aware of changes, new things that have come in, pushback, resistance. It's my community, right? So I read its newspapers and I follow. I'm on the up and up with what's happening. But I think I'm also observing, I'm observant to begin with. So I think I'm observing other people too. In terms of observing the observant, I think sometimes it's interesting as I get older. I think when I was younger, you know, big key figures in the community, it was like, oh, this rabbi, that rabbi, this head of an institution. And as I get older and my friends get further along in their careers, it's like I can see the day that we are going to be those people, that I'm going to know the person who is now leading X organization or the woman who's leading Y organization. And that to me is very interesting, that it's not always something from the outside being forced upon us, but really knowing more intimately the people that are actually in the power positions that will determine to a certain extent where our community goes, what it looks like, who's in, who's out, and what its texture is.
And one last question.
Yeah.
What would you like to see in a documentary called Observing the Observant?
The first thing that comes to mind is definitely a fair amount, and I would want an equal amount of women's voices, and not just because of parity of the sexes. I think so many times I see these documentaries and it's like all these men and then two women. And I think that women have a lot to share. You know, we might not be as great, well, this is audio, we might not be as great visually because we don't have the lavush, we don't have the clothing and the payas, the side curls, and you know, all the different accoutrements that come with that kind of dress. But I think that the women, I think sometimes the men get to live more extreme lives, grow up very this and then very that. But I think behind all those men, there's a woman who is left and divorced and has 4 children. And I think that's like a whole other story that hasn't been told. You know, a lot of the, I think about it a lot when I come to, can I talk about Chilant? When I come to Chilant, I think a lot about, there are usually a lot more men than women from the observant communities. And like, there's always some divorced wife that was left holding the bag. I'm not saying that people should be in a situation that's bad just because you don't want someone to be left holding the bag. But I think that there's that out there. I think it's all in the editing. I think it's having, you know, choosing bites. And I think maybe it's also pushing beyond just the kind of voyeuristic or sexy stuff, and really getting to the earnestness behind it, and also listening to what's new. You know, it's not having it be something like a price above rubies or all these other things that have been done, but having a keen ear to listen to what might be hinting towards the next 15 years in the community, and not just the tried and true stuff that we know.
I want to show the rainbow of possibilities. I don't want to show the beauty,
right,
only, and I don't want to show the ugliness.
Right.
But I want to show it all, and I want people to walk away feeling like they've gotten a little more insight.
Yeah.
And but even more so, a feeling that there is joy and there is sadness.
Right. And there's struggle and there's elation.
Right. Oh, so there was one question I meant to ask you, which was your relationship to music.
My relationship to music. My dad is a chazan. He's a cantor. And I grew up with that, you know, with him having a voice and him knowing a lot of nigunim and being very, not nigunim, more like smirat, more songs that we would sing on Shabbat. But it's definitely like a lebedik, a very hearty type of thing. And then all throughout school I was in choirs. I think for me, music carries things. I think it carries emotions and it carries feelings, and sometimes it expresses things for me better than if I could put it in words. And I think for me, music, there's two kinds, right? There's kinds that have words, and then there's kinds that are just tunes, nigunim. And I think it's both those things. It's like something that I can express things through, and sometimes that can also bring me to certain places. And sometimes it's a matter of going into a trance quality and really being transported to someplace else. That for me really happens uniquely through music.
Thank you.
Okay.
We may continue this.
I think we got through a lot.
Yeah. I may have some more questions for you as they come along to get your...
For sure.
Yeah. And how would you like to be known in this, your name?
Yeah, Tali, T-A-L-I, Aronsky, A-R-O-N-S-K-Y.
Great. Great. It's okay if I use this in a documentary or whatever?
Yes, yes.
Okay, great.
I'm signing the release.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, we're continuing.
Going back to what you were asking about sexuality and hormones, I remember I was talking earlier about feeling in high school that it was almost like pre-sexual, like I somehow wasn't tapped into that energy, what was going on. I was speaking with a friend of mine who also grew up modern Orthodox in New Jersey. I went to a school that was similar to mine. I went to Yeshiva Flapa, she went to Frisch. Both of these schools that you're with guys together for English subjects and apart for Hebrew subjects. I remember her saying, because later on she went to teach in one of these schools, and she one time saw some guys that she had gone to school with, you know, 15 years ago, and or 10 years, yeah, 15 years ago, and they were saying, like, she was like, yeah, I really don't remember it being an issue or a problem, like hormones, whatever, I don't know, I had guys and we were friends, and it just wasn't such a big deal. And then she spoke with a few guys that she went to high school with, and they were like, oh my God, what do you mean it wasn't a big deal? Like, we were dying, all this look, don't touch, and all the girls in their skirts and their little tight tops and puberty and hormones, and that for them it was a very big deal and very difficult, and that they were not feeling the pre-sexual thing at all. And I think it was very funny for me, because when she was saying that, I knew what she was talking about. And then when she thought that guys had the same experience and that they were actually dying and not feeling at all like, oh, I didn't realize, and it wasn't such a big deal, and I didn't feel this urge. I just was doing my thing and going to school and doing my homework and taking tests. So I think that might be a difference between, I don't know, men and women, or just us, or me and my friends. But I remember that.
Well, there maybe is a lot less... fashion, the self-consciousness.
No, there is. No, there's definitely cliques and fashion and pecking orders like any other high school and any other social.
Is there a dress code? Was there a dress code in your school?
No sneakers, shirts with collars, like no t-shirts, and skirts that passed our knee. So we were dressed up for high school. I actually dressed better in high school than I did in college, because college I just would wear jeans every day. And in high school, you know, guys couldn't wear jeans, so they were wearing pants. And if you can't wear a t-shirt, then you're wearing a button-down shirt or a polo.
Now, and you went to Penn State?
No, University of Pennsylvania. UPenn.
So that's a non-yeshiva school, obviously.
Right. Yeah, it's non-yeshiva.
And how was that when you first got there?
I mean, I grew up wearing pants on the weekends and after school. So I think I remember feeling very dressed down for school. I remember being shocked a bit by that, because I had definitely dressed up more when I was in high school. And yeah, the dorms were co-ed, and thinking, wow, this is very, you know, we're all sharing the same bathrooms. I don't know. I think, thank God for me, I've always had a steady center, so that when I go into new experiences, my boat doesn't... I like new experiences. I'm very open to them, but my boat doesn't rock from one side to the other and then I capsize. It always kind of like goes through.
Now, you worked at CBS.
Yeah.
How was that for you, being in a secular world?
It wasn't like the first time I was in a secular
world.
What was challenging was working in a news environment that's demanding and 24/7 and being Sabbath observant. I think the way I made it work was being very upfront. I told them when I interviewed for the job, not after. You know, I wasn't hoping that I would start the job in the summer when the Sabbath doesn't start till late, and hope that no major
crisis
would happen on a Friday. I told them up front, I'm like, I'm really good at what I do, but I'm Sabbath observant. So I'll work, you know, I'll work Saturday night and I'll work Sundays and I'll work Christmas and Thanksgiving and holidays. But come hell or high water, I'm not working unless it's a life and death situation on the Saturday. And I think that me putting it out there that I respect my religion, but I really care about my job, and I will work other hours and overtime so that no one feels that they're being taken advantage of, that I'm leaving work early. And I did. I used to work Saturday night, you know. I would come into work. I would work Sundays. I worked all these holidays. And I lost most of my vacation time for the first 5 years, but I only had 10 days of vacation a year, 2 weeks. A lot of times when there were holidays that everything was in the middle of the week, I lost almost all my vacation time to holidays. And I think sometimes it was a little bit annoying, because you actually want to have vacation, and Jewish holidays don't always feel like a vacation.
No, they don't.
They feel like work.
Especially Yom Kippur.
Yeah, or even when you have like a two-day holiday that goes right into the Sabbath, and there's so much work in preparation, food-wise, and that you need a vacation after the holiday to like recoup from the Jewish holiday. But I think it's like any other relationship or any other, I mean, covenant is a strong word. It's like any other relationship. It's not always pleasant. It's not always fun, but I always feel the benefits.
Well, I think there's a kind of a gift to life, and some of us appreciate it in different ways.
Yeah.
There's always something to learn, isn't there?
Yeah.
So we shall continue.
We shall continue.